Welcome to Walk the Talk, a private podcast production with me, Dave Thomas. Thank you for downloading this edition of the programme. I do hope you enjoy it. Having sold his business and looking for something to do, his late father advised him to join the police for no other reason than he was tall enough. Well, 25 years later, he's done rather well for himself and is now the Deputy Chief Constable of Lancashire Constabulary. Andy Rhodes has had a remarkable career, reaching the rank of superintendent in 11 short years. Even more remarkable, considering he was not earmarked for the High Potential Development Scheme. Having commanded several high-profile events, and more recently overseen the response to the flooding in and around Lancashire, you would think that this was a man in control. Yet several years ago, behind the success at work, lay an altogether different story that would lead to his own personal crisis and the breakup of his marriage. It could have ended his career, but drawing on that experience, Andy Rhodes began his own painful journey of studying the effects of adverse childhood experiences, which taught him a lot about his own resilience and character. Turning to study and a prolific reader, he gained a master's degree and a postgraduate qualification in coaching, helping him understand his favourite subject, people. Now the national lead on well-being for the police within England and Wales, Andy Rhodes is looking at early intervention, personal responsibility and emotional intelligence, all vital ingredients to personal and psychological well-being. A busy husband and father, he enjoys taking part in triathlons, having just returned from a major event in Spain. He's also managed to find time to set up the charity Strong Young Minds with his new wife Helen, promoting emotional resilience in young people, taking the message into local schools. More recently, he won the Barclays Ally Award for work with Stonewall, a charity involved with the LGBT community, a subject he feels very strongly about, and in 2015 was awarded the Queen's Police Medal. So why is this ex-support unit officer equally at home dealing with counter-terrorism as he is with the messy and often controversial subject of well-being? Well, we're about to find out. As I am delighted to say, he joins me now.
I'd like to turn the tables on you, if I may, and start by asking you a question you yourself will have asked many times to people sat in the interview chair, and that is, what is it like to be led by you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is a question that we ask, because I think it leads you into providing an answer that's informed by feedback you get from other people, which is something quite often leaders don't do. Quite often, and it happens the more senior you are, people will tell you everything's fine, all your ideas are great. Mm-hmm. And the real key, I think, to good leadership is having people around you prepared to give you feedback. And it also leads you into how much you're doing about your own personal development. So it's really important to understand yourself, but also to understand your impact on other people and getting that sense of, you know, do I really understand what it's like to be around me on a day-to-day basis? Mm-hmm. I do genuinely have a view that it's not about the hero leader anymore. I think in some aspects of particularly our culture, the big operational leader is seen as the be-all end-all of leadership. And it is a role, obviously, it's clearly a role for us, particularly if there's a crisis happening, that we need people to step up to that very directive leadership style that's around command and control. But more often than not now, particularly when you're trying to get the best out of people, deliver change, it's about you as a person, how you treat other people, how you build trust with them. Mm. And those are very personal aspects of leadership.
You did say, I mean, you're right, and a lot of people at the top of the game say this, that they get frustrated that people aren't themselves with the bosses.
Yeah.
Do you find that?
I do,
quite often.
And I think there's an interesting piece of work I read recently about, are you aware when you, do you really know when you've made a decision? Because in a meeting as a senior person, particularly in a hierarchical organisation, if you say something like, I think that's a good idea, that becomes in some eyes, some people's eyes, a decision. And they start doing things as a result of it. Right. When you might, particularly if you're someone who likes to extrovert their ideas, have thrown a load of different ideas out. So what I've learned over the past, because I get a lot of my energy from talking, and I like big idea conversations. If for other people around me who are more thoughtful and like things to have been thought through from A to Z, if I just throw an idea out there, they'll think, well, you must have done what I like doing, which is thinking about this before you've come out with your idea. So you must have done all that, so therefore we must be doing it. Are you with me? And I've learned from doing work with my teams, understanding how they think and make decisions, that we're all very different. So you've got to be really careful with what you throw out there to people. I was speaking to a senior leader colleague of mine the other day, and he said, since I arrived in this job as chief constable, I've never had a bad idea. It's worrying me. And that's positive, that it's worrying him, because nobody's telling him any of his ideas are bad, and some of them must be bad ideas.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting, because that brings me on to a question that I was going to ask, but you've sort of mentioned it. And I'm just wondering if you ever suffer fear. You know, a number of successful people have moments of self-doubt and should I be here? Am I up to the task? I'm just wondering if those thoughts ever cross your mind.
Well, I'll tell you the honest answer to that one is the worst time I've ever had that imposter syndrome was I did a 12-hour shift as a custody sergeant in Blackpool Central Custody, filling in for somebody else. So I was promoted after only 3.5 years to sergeant. And I went back to Blackpool, where I'd been a probationer, as a sergeant. And I was pretty comfortable at running around doing the operational stuff. Mm. But when it came to the custody office, I'd never had a custody course. And it was a Monday morning, a 12-12, 6-6. It's one of the hardest days I've ever had in my service. A, it's a really tough environment. B, I felt like I was riding a wild horse all day, and I just didn't really know what I was signing when people were putting things in front of me, to be quite honest. But I go on this theory of flow, right? So it's quite natural to be uncomfortable if the skills and knowledge you've got aren't suited to the task, aren't the right level. It's like when you first start driving. It's really uncomfortable, isn't it? But eventually you get a bit bored with it. So there's a natural tendency, and I have quite a high tendency to want to stretch myself with whatever I'm doing. So I've learned over the years it's normal to be anxious. And it's okay if you're comfortable with yourself to say, I don't understand this. What I didn't want to do when I was a sergeant, because I hadn't got that level of self-awareness, was go and say, I don't really understand some of this. I wanted to go in, because I was a sergeant, and pretend I knew what I was doing, which is quite dangerous. But the older I've got and the more personal development I've done, the more comfortable I am with saying, actually, I don't understand what you've just said to me. Can you explain it? What do you mean by that?
Mm.
It's not weakness, but quite often in big meetings when there's important stuff being discussed, there's loads of people around the table who haven't a clue what you're talking about, but are too anxious to say. So part of my job is to create the culture where it's all right to say,
yes.
I don't really understand that. Or
I suppose it's the old thing of there's never a stupid question,
is there? Never a stupid question.
Yeah.
No.
You strike me as somebody that takes things very personally. Does this help you drive your work forward? And perhaps you could share your wellbeing portfolio. What can we expect in 2017?
I am passionate about the wellbeing agenda, as you've said, Dave, which I think is one of the reasons for sat here, to be quite honest. I'm passionate about it for a couple of reasons, actually. One is that fundamentally I believe that work, whatever work it is you're doing, should be something that's something really valuable in your life. You know, you spend so much time doing it.
Mm.
That comes from my own family experiences of work being, the work ethic being overplayed, and something I've seen in my father, where work has been a millstone around his neck.
Right.
Sometimes, you know, he's done work to earn money, keep his family, but eventually I think it damaged his health irretrievably. And I don't think that's how it should be. You know, I think we should all be trying to come to work and thrive, which leads me into why don't we? What stops us? And the wellbeing agenda and the work that I've done around that comes from a really good evidence base around what things need to be in place at work for us to thrive. Not just survive, and police work is an extreme working environment. And I think, you know, my experiences of what it's like when you go through a bit of a blip in the police world is it is a very, very up-tempo, reactive environment that you can very quickly fall off.
Mm.
And it's a struggle to get back on it. And you don't realise that until you have a bit of a blip, that the pace we operate at and the culture that we have, which is very can-do, has its downsides.
Mm.
So I come at it from, I think, the things that we expose our people to in policing, the way that we deliver change, hugely stressful, high emotional labour. Therefore, it's endless, our pursuit of what we should do to equip and support people in that environment. And ultimately, that's good for the public.
Mm.
It's not great for the public to have frazzled cops.
Yes. And I suppose that leads us on to post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I know you've been looking at...
That's right. So for next year, these are the three big things I'm looking at nationally on wellbeing. One is the launch of a police-specific wellbeing framework that's based on the evidence we know, building on the national wellbeing charter that's for all organisations. We've built on that and we've said there's certain unique things that police staff and officers need building into this. And that's the standard and kite mark by which every force should be striving to achieve. So it's got new stuff in there around trauma, exposure to indecent image viewing, lots of stuff we've learnt, sleep, diet, all sorts of stuff that's really tuned in. So this is the standard by which employers in policing should assess themselves against, and it's going to be in the HMRC Peel inspection. Believe you me, in 2 or 3 years, we've gone a long way.
Mm.
And there's a big appetite for it. That's one thing. The second thing is we're going to take the lid off post-traumatic stress, and we're going to have a conference that we're planning at the moment, supported by the Police Dependence Trust. We're going to bring in academic experts, experts from the military, who've got a lot of research and knowledge in this, people that combat stress. Mm. And we're going to say, this is what we think we know about trauma in policing. This is what other organisations know. Where are our gaps and what do we need to fill, particularly around prevention of trauma, which we are not, and stigma and all that, which we're not there with yet.
Mm.
And the third one, which is an even bigger challenge, is trying to pursue a similar model to the military have with the NHS. So in the NHS system, people are aware of your military background, as they're aware that you are a family member of somebody who's got a military armed forces
mm.
background. It's not about preferential treatment. It's about, from you being an armed forces personnel, from the day you joined, the day you die, the health service, the health system being more aware and understanding the context of why you might be presenting. So in the military, prosthetics mm. are a big issue. So if you're 82 and you go into the NHS system and you need, you know, prosthetic renewing, the awareness that this comes from your military background and has come from something serving your country is in the system. Don't mean preferential treatment, it means that there's a different context. For policing, it may well be more around things like mental health. So say, for example, you retire and in 15 years, some of the things you've seen are causing you some problems around stress, anxiety, depression, mm. alcohol, whatever it might be. You go into the NHS system, I want them to be aware that that may have come from while you're doing public service
mm.
and experienced some of this really traumatic stuff.
Mm.
So I'm currently negotiating with the NHS and looking to do a piece of work next year that I think will be the biggest thing that we've done for serving and retired police personnel,
mm.
Very similar to the military. I'm getting supported by the military that do that, the armed forces people who do that at the moment.
Because I think people, when they think of post-traumatic stress disorder, they think of a big incident.
Yes,
we've
that's
certainly
right.
have had big incidents yeah. recently in the current mm-hmm. climate. But I think the majority of police was more that drip-drip effect.
It's very much a drip-drip. And I think I'm trying to get that message across to people that we need more research about that. We need more interventions. So what we're developing in Lancashire is the early intervention model for wellbeing. When you take that in terms of prevention, what we should be doing is mandatory group debriefs of all our frontline staff and people at CSIs and call handlers regularly. As you would have if you were a psychotherapist or counsellor, you've got to have supervision, and there's a very good reason why you need to have that, because all sorts of things start happening as you experience situations and complex people that then have an impact on you and how your attitudes and beliefs change. So I think that is not just about well-being and post-traumatic stress, it's about the quality of service to the public as well. Things like bias, compassion.
I guess if you realise there's a problem, sometimes it's too late then, isn't it? Once you realise that.
Well, you and I both know, when we joined the job, didn't we? I came from a fairly middle-class background. The first time I went to a suicide, a post-mortem, I was like traumatised. Now looking back at it for weeks, and I still think about it. You know, there's still things, and I didn't spend as much time on the front line as you have, but, you know, I when I go to certain places, I recall things that happened there.
Yes.
Even when I'm out cycling on my bike, I recall some stuff that I've experienced. So it's in there somewhere, isn't it? And, you know, we just need to acknowledge that, you know, it's normal. It's about the processing of that positively. That's where our gap is. It isn't processed. We used to do it in the pub after a 2:10, maybe. And we don't do that anymore. There were certain things socially that the police did that are now not in place. Big teams, you've got, you know, staff booking on their own, using mobile data, going and doing the job, coming back, booking off at the police station, middle of nowhere, nobody's talking to them. Another big area is specials. You know, specials can experience, just like us, some fairly traumatic stuff, and then they go back to their own workplace that isn't even aware.
I think as well, the organisation, not just this organisation, the police organisation as a whole, we almost take this view of that it almost becomes normal.
And we
forget that it's far from normal.
It's not normal.
It's exactly the opposite of normal.
But that's one of the things, when you haven't processed experiences, you start to normalise them. That in some senses is necessary for a police officer, because they need to do their job for the public in quite stressful situations, don't they? Need to be able to cope with it. My point is that what you will see is a form of numbness, and that is not resilience. Numbness is about putting up a defence shield, and you see that a lot, and you'll hear it when you pick the phone up, people sometimes, in any walk of life, actually. Go to the EasyJet desk that's used to getting a lot of complaints, and they'll have a look on the face, won't they, as if, say, here comes another one. So it happens because of a reason. And ultimately, in our job, I believe that one of the things that makes our people extraordinary is the ability to be compassionate despite of all that. Because if someone knocks at my door at 3 o'clock in the morning, God forbid, I need compassion. I don't want numbness. Do you know what I mean? And that takes exceptional people, but I think we've got to acknowledge that we can lose compassion in the job because it's a form of defence mechanism. And what I'm interested in is all the interventions early that we're starting to look at here around this clinical supervision model aren't just at the crisis end, they're about mandatory debriefs for everybody in a group situation. The NHS are doing quite a bit of work around this as well.
You've previously mentioned the permafrost existing at senior management level prevented the message of well-being being transported down into the organisation. Those that know you and work with you will say that you have a well-used phrase, and are you with me? Well, are they with you?
I think the staff engagement work that we've done, that's been one of the toughest things I've done here, has been quite unpopular with some leaders. I think some of them fundamentally don't believe in the benefits of staff engagement because they haven't looked at the evidence for it. You know, being involved in your organisation, engagement is, the evidence base is very strong, which is why top organisations across the globe are maxing out on it. So I don't think some of them fundamentally believe in that it gets you, but that's linked to a personal issue where actually they find it very difficult to communicate.
People that we are, aren't we?
Well, yeah, and they don't like to be challenged, some people. I think in a rank-oriented organisation, you know, at the end of the day, there's this sort of people quite get used to deferential treatment. But it is quite difficult because I have another great saying, actually, that people, you judge yourself on your intentions, but other people judge you on your behaviours. And so many times I see great people I've got who are in leadership positions who are quite confused that something they've done has created a perception. And they'll go, that's not me. That's not what perception I want to create, right? But we have created it.
Mm.
And that is difficult, that, for a leader to understand that something you've said or done, maybe unwittingly, has created this perception and a lack of trust. So it's just about getting people's heads around, right? How I made Dave feel is important.
Mm.
Are you with me? It may not have changed what I had to do, but I've got to acknowledge that I have an impact on people's feelings. And that can, things like fairness, which are a massive issue for staff, it can break down trust.
Mm.
So that's why we're clearing up promotion processes. It's difficult, it's tough. Some people don't like it. That's why we're putting different things into promotion processes. That's why we are having authentic conversations with people about their integrity and some of the things that they say and do. And I think we're getting there. I do think we're getting there. I think the last promotion boards I did to chief inspector, and I sat on every single one, I would say that the vast majority, 99% of those people that got through, have got great values. Some of them aren't aware of them and they don't deploy them enough. Some of them are still thinking, I'm a bit worried about maybe deference being dead. But for the new generation of people coming to policing, they are not into standing up in rooms and saluting. Are you with me? That they will only follow you if they believe you've got the right values.
And this is the problem we have to a certain extent, because we still are a disciplined service to a large extent. We have to be.
We have to be.
To do the work that we do.
That's right.
It's finding that balance.
It is. It's not throwing the baby out with the bathwater, because one of the great things about police work is we can get a decision from the top to the front line through quickly in a crisis, particularly.
Mm.
But I'll tell you now, Dave, you say we're a disciplined organisation. When it comes to behavioural change, people won't do it if they don't believe in it. Are you with me? They'll march up a street with a shield in their hand, having bricks thrown at them. But actually, if you want to change behaviours, they've got to believe in you. And they've got to have, you know, they've got to trust that your values, the reason you're doing it isn't to get promoted.
Mm.
Do you see what I mean?
Yes. Well, I suppose that kind of answers my next question I was going to ask you. That obviously many folks listening to this will say that, you know, it's great that Andy Rose is doing all this. But some of them are wondering, how is it going to affect them in their day-to-day work on the front line? And indeed, how is it going to help them when demand is still rising?
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the things that we know from doing our work around demand, for example, is that we've just done a piece of work in contact management. We've looked at 900 jobs. And it won't come any surprise to you as a frontline officer, but the profile of those jobs is changing significantly.
Mm.
And it's more around complex needs, vulnerability, rather than traditional crime. What we find is that when we look at what's stopping you achieving your purpose, most times when you go to a job, you're pretty clear on what you're there to do.
Mm.
It's keep people safe, isn't it? It's to reassure them, it's to catch the baddies or whatever. What's stopping you doing that? 95% of it is not driven by you. 95% of it's driven by how inefficient the system is. Bureaucracy, handing over jobs from place to place, you know, decision making that's risk averse. So what you've got to be careful with the wellbeing agenda is this very point you've mentioned, right? It can't just be a rhetorical, we want to treat everybody better. Because actually the nature of our work's designed is one of the most stressful things that most people will have to put up with.
Mm.
It's not having any purpose in the work. So when we first asked people, what's your wellbeing in this force, we got 12,000 hits on that buzz site that said, it's about target culture. It's about targets and it's about behaviours around performance. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
It wasn't about, was it, my shifts are too long or I'm rolling around the floor with somebody with a machete. Logistics are a big part of, you know, culture, leadership, behaviours. These are all the things that...
People have to have a worth, don't they?
People have to feel valued. They have to feel that the place is fair, even if they're not getting what they want, that things are fair. And we are on a journey with that one. You know, we're on a journey with all these things. And I think what you'll start seeing over time, people will start seeing far more openness, far more willingness to listen. So, you know, I've done things on the bus where I've, you know, in a moment of frustration, I've said something to somebody that's, you know, I don't feel very grateful you're working for me or something like that. And I got two emails off two frontline officers at Blackpool separately. He said, I don't know you, boss, but I think you're out of order doing that. You tell me if somebody had done that 10 years ago. You know, and I had to say to them, yeah, you're right, my wife said I shouldn't have sent it either. You know, and I apologise. You know, not enough people in leadership positions apologise when they get it wrong. Or prepared to go back and look at decisions they made and go, yeah, it was a bad decision, that, let's rewind it. So I think in terms of how work's designed, Dave, there is a huge amount of technical work going on here to remove the chaff that frustrates you. And some of that you may not even know is going to affect you on the front line, but it's been done because it's good for people's well-being. It's also efficient. You know, it's efficient because demand's going up and resources going down. So we've got to get the chaff out of the system. And the second thing is, I know this, you will start seeing behavioural changes. It's going to be slow because the turnover of people in policing is very slow. Most organisations in the public sector have a 12% per annum turnover rate. Police is about 4%. Because people retire, basically, and that's how they leave. So, you know, in terms of the acceleration of cultural change, it's slower in the police because ultimately some people just need to, you know, generation of people who have done it one way eventually leave, and a generation of people who've never done it any other way. What I think you've got to do with cultural change is start with, well, we've established what the way that we want to be around here is. We're putting all these things in place. Eventually, over time, just like it's different than when you and I joined, it'll be different here. Be long after my time, but somebody's got to roll the sleeves up and start doing the work now.
I think change in any organisation is almost like a game of chicken. Who's the first to flinch? You know, it's that I'm Spartacus moment,
and it takes
that one person to.
Well, technically, I mean, some of the people like your Celine Schillingers, who I know you'll have seen on Twitter, she'll say that, well, this is what happens percentage wise with change. 3% of people will just do it, because they're like the early adopters, and they'll great idea, and they just like new stuff. You'll get something like, I think she said, it's like 15-16% of people will do it because they believe in you and they like you. You'll get about another 30-odd% of people who, if you can convince them that the reason you're doing it is the right reason, and you're prepared to sit down with them, talk them through it and explain your reasons, and they buy into it, they'll do it. What you get then is a really interesting group of people, about another 30-40%, who don't want to be in the minority. And they will, that's the chicken bit. They will, there'll be a point in your cultural change in your organisation where people think, well, I don't want to be the one who isn't doing it. That's happening now in Lancashire, I'm telling you now, particularly at a leadership level. People are getting it, that actually, I'm standing out here. I used to be the atypical version. I'm now looking like the B prototype. You know what I mean? And the new minis come in, and I'm the old one, and I don't like that. So I'm going to tuck in with these other people. And then there's about 20% of people who you just need to wait till they've left. Yes. Do you know what I mean? You know, don't overly consume yourself with them, because you miss the people at the front, at the vanguard of it. So that's the nature of change. And it's long, it's slow, it's difficult. But, you know, the job of a leader is that you basically, you're passing through your organisation at a point in its history. So your job is to do your bit for the future, is my view.
Yes, not like a relay runner.
It is, that's right.
You've put on record your own crisis, divorce, bankruptcy, sleep deprivation. In fact, your new wife Helen described you as having sad eyes on photographs taken during that time. What advice would Andy Rhodes have given himself back then?
Really good question, that. It was almost bankruptcy. Very, very close. Weeks away. First thing was to take responsibility for how I ended up where I was, and not blame other people, because it's quite often the case when you're in particularly a bit of a personal crisis, you look for other people than yourself to blame. And I think A lot of people in leadership positions have had some form of crisis that's been a wake-up call, and that was mine. And looking back at myself then, could I have avoided it? Yes, I could have avoided it. The way I would have avoided it, Dave, would have been I would have actually have been more self-aware, because you only have a personal crisis when something creeps up on you because you're not aware of how you're responding to your external environment and what's happening inside. And so the fact that it actually ended up in a train crash was my responsibility completely, nobody else's. And after that, I took responsibility and had a good hard look at myself. And I've done a lot of very, very personal development, supported by other people, particularly, my current wife, would say, who's fortunately got some expertise in this area.
Your hardest critic.
Your hardest critic, yeah. And she's a psychotherapist and she understands it. I understand the theory. And I wish I'd known that theory when I was a kid, I have to say, because I'd probably have had less ups and downs throughout my whole life. But you learn from your mistakes, don't you?
Mm.
So, yeah, I'd have said to me that when people talk about resilience and well-being, they think that it's about somebody coming and giving them something. When actually it's not. It's about your self-awareness. Mm. That is the main issue about your own personal resilience is self-awareness.
And it sort of brings me to, and with a certain sense of frustration, is, and certainly, highlighted recently with several officers that unfortunately has led to their dismissal, but the problems that led up to that, and you would talk with the work colleagues and, oh, yes, we were aware of this problem.
Yeah, yeah.
And, well, nobody said anything.
No. And that's not the compassionate thing to do, is it? Why do we dive out of the way of our colleagues when they look like they're struggling? When I was struggling, I could see people doing a quick, sharp right into the nearest office to get out of my way, because they find it uncomfortable to talk about personal issues in a work environment. Like, people leave those at the door before they come in. If you're a police officer or police staff in some roles and you are struggling, it's a very high-risk occupation to be struggling in.
Mm.
And that often leads to other things. If you've got problems with debt, which we know a lot of staff have, you've got a problem with your relationships. These are things that people need to feel comfortable approaching someone in the workplace to let them know about.
Mm.
Because, like most things, Dave, isn't it? Most problems can be solved if you put your hand up early enough, get to the bottom of them.
Very nice. It brings me on to my next question. Resilience at the moment is obviously one of the hot topics up there with discretionary effort, goodwill.
Yeah.
Is there a danger that as an organisation makes every effort to look after its staff, folk will shift their own well-being responsibility onto the organisation? So in a sense, how can we be more resilient?
Mm. Well, that's a really good question, that, because I think your resilience is fundamentally your responsibility. My well-being is my responsibility. I think it's about equipping, particularly your line managers, with the skills and having them commit to developing the right level of emotional intelligence to have the conversation. That is the nub of the wellbeing challenge, because line managers are so important, as are peers. So what is your emotional intelligence capability in this organisation to deliver this agenda? Right, well, like in most walks of life, it's probably not where you want it to be. Are you with me? So,
yes.
But we do have people with fantastic levels of emotional intelligence who are stepping up into this area through doing peer support work by some of our new leaders that are coming through that are very, very self-aware. And they are the sort of people who could have that conversation with you that's like, actually, Dave, this isn't all about work. Some of this is about what you're going to do. Because you have your own solutions. The person-centred approach to this would be about you finding your own solutions, not me providing them. But where policing's currently at is, we're really, in wellbeing terms, still dealing with the crisis end, mainly, or, through Occhi Health and all that. So quite a lot of things were only kicking in when things have gone badly wrong. So, my optimism around this, Dave, is that, 83% of staff look like they're doing okay. But as Carrie Cooper says, the absence of sickness doesn't mean to say you're well.
Mm.
That's where we need to do the work.
And I suppose that means, you know, if I have a well-being issue, I'm going to see my immediate supervisor.
Mm.
And if I'm let down in that process by my immediate supervisor, then everything falls down. Then.
Exactly, exactly. And that's happened to me. In fact, my immediate supervisor has been the problem quite often. You know what I mean? So this should be there as your first point of call, port of call. But actually, some people say, well, you know, there's a personal preference around this. My first port of call wouldn't be to my line manager if I had a personal issue. It'd be to maybe a family member or a colleague who I have a bit of contact with who I could ring up on again. I get phone calls from people who, you know, in, you know, chief officers who I've been friendly with, and sometimes just want to offload something from work on a Friday night when they're driving home about something's happened. That's cathartic, you know what I mean? And they want to share something with me and they drop me a text, ring me. So it's a very personal thing who you disclose this to. But as you say, what we're working on, Dave, because we know we've got that issue, as have a lot of organisations, US military doing loads on this with first line management, is that we are currently working on a whole new website for the National Working Group, funded by Public Health England. It's got its own brand that is police specific, blue light specific, and there are opportunities there to acknowledge and recognise people who in the workplace are good at this stuff and actually badge them up. Because the people who've done the branding say, you like badges in the cops, don't you? You sort of like get, you know. And we will have, for example, people in the workplace wearing a PIN badge, and it's going to be called Oscar Kilo OK, because we know sometimes it's not OK to talk. They'll be wearing a small Oscar Kilo PIN badge. And if you're having a bad day and you walk down the corridor, it might be a complete stranger. If they're wearing an Oscar Kilo badge, you can be assured that that's somebody who we think, yeah, has got the necessary emotional intelligence, and they're also hooked into the clinical governance model of the organisation. That's what's happening here. So it's not just about a friendly chat. They can access you all sorts of different things. Mm. And you can then go, all right, okay. I don't have to run the risk here of you not being interested or thinking I'm weak.
Yeah.
That's a signal to me, yeah, that you are open to being approached.
Because I think the biggest kickstart to getting better, if you want to use that phrase, is that, you know, showing a problem with somebody and they will say that, well, I know how you're feeling. I've had that problem myself. There's nothing worse than thinking, oh, I'm the only one that feels like this.
Right.
And nine times out of ten, you're not.
Which is why disclosure of officers and staff who've been through some of these things is very powerful. That's why the buzz is very powerful. You look at some of the things on the buzz that have come out recently about the ARV officer who felt he was being bad-mouthed, saying all the ARV officer after he'd been through quite a traumatic incident, hadn't he?
Mm.
And people started understanding a bit more about how he felt. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm back to my original point, aren't I? You know, that how you feel is everything. Do you know what I mean? How you feel is everything. But honestly, some people, if you say to me, how are you feeling? I go, oh, well, I'm not feeling anything. They're not aware of how they're feeling, but it's having an impact on them.
Yes.
Which is why the self-awareness is important.
Blackpool will soon be getting a brand new state-of-the-art police station. In fact, I think...
The spade went in the ground this morning.
Indeed. I'm interested to know if has well-being been designed into the plan?
It certainly has. It certainly has. It's a big theme for that building. It's built into not just the design of the building. If I said to you, right, I'll go from probably the worst example, which is Blackpool Police Station we've got now.
Mm.
I have a fondness for that place, but I don't have to work in it now because I started there and it's like faded. It's an awful building, isn't it?
You only remember the good times.
You only remember the good times. It's got sick building syndrome. You go to Green Bank at Blackburn, you know what, 12, 13 years old, it's a lot better.
Mm.
You go to Preston, Op Centre, I think there's a great feel around that building. It's light, it's airy, offices are accessible, you see people, you feel part of a bigger team there. Blackpool will be even better. So the design principles behind it are all around wellness, well-being, team environment. There's a lot of stuff in there around, we don't have small offices with a name on the door that's, you know, difficult to get into. It's all about the one team. And there are specific things around breakout areas that are built into that building where, for example, I could just grab you and have a chat over, you know, in a comfortable area that's not about, you know, it's built into the nature of the building. It's quite a modern space. We've had a really good suggestion here, which we want to replicate elsewhere, which is about getting some charitable money to create a wellbeing route around headquarters. There's a lot of people view some nasty stuff up here every day. You know, there's some stressful jobs. I think contact management is very stressful sometimes. And we're going to be getting some charitable money to basically do a really nice walking route around headquarters with certain spaces where you can get a bit of chill out, obviously when it's not raining. But I'm encouraging people to come up with their own ideas around this, you know. I see around my network nationally, you know, some PCSOs in GMP have just got a room that's not been used in their police station. They've been allowed to turn it into a chill out room for them. That's their space, you know, and that sort of thing we should be encouraging, you know, more from people to, you know, to come up with their ideas themselves. So the idea about the headquarters here came up from an individual who works in, I think, contact management, you know, and he said, seems a shame this. I saw the pond. It's a right old mess. Why don't we do it up? And then it's ballooned into, well, why don't we have a wellbeing route? So yeah. It's a beautiful site, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, and when you, my reflections on hearing the experiences of people who do the indecent image viewing, for example, is that, you know, they need, and part and parcel of the package that we do for them is what works for you here in terms of, you know, transferring from doing that work to actually going home and seeing your family. Well, some of it is about having some time, maybe on your own or ex, whatever it is for you, mindfulness, whatever it might be, to get your head back into a positive place where you can go and then relate to your family.
But, well, it's interesting you mention taking work home with you.
Yeah.
And I guess in your role, it's an operational necessity. So I'm just wondering how you sort of switch off from all that.
Well, I'm... I don't, to be honest. I have, and you know, I'm comfortable with this. I've integrated my work and home life. It helps that my wife hasn't known any different to this, but I've been really clear with her that at the level I'm operating at, this is like when I used to run a business, because I ran a business before I came into the police, and that was a 24 hours a day job. Believe you me, you know, you're always thinking about it. You always had one eye on it. And I think at the level I'm operating at, there is not a clear cutoff. I also quite like doing work at home that's work-related, if it's in an area that I'm passionate about. I do firearms command, I do CT command. These are roles that are, you know, you're permanently on your phone anyway, on some sort of rotor.
Yes.
You know, so I think it's a leadership responsibility at a certain level, but also to take responsibility to make sure that's not affecting your wellbeing. So, you know, I'm not a trade-off here because my kids are older, they've gone, they've left home. I'm not trading off like some people might be with younger children. So it's okay for me. I wouldn't advocate it for everybody. And what I've got to be careful of is that people don't start replicating what I do. So I've had feedback about emails at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
That some of the senior people around me think, oh, I've got to be looking at my emails at 4 o'clock in the morning. So, you know, I try to stop doing some of those things. But it works for me because I enjoy it. You know what I mean? And I keep myself fit and balanced. Sometimes I have problems with sleep. Quite horrendous problems with sleep, so I get on work.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned your other business, and coming to the end of this interview, I guess, but curious as to what qualities you brought from your previous employment, your business. And I ask that against the current debate, really, of police now and direct entry superintendents.
I came into this job after doing, well, I was an accountant to start with, and I ran a family business that was very physically very hard work and quite stressful. So I think in a very sort of amateurish, probably looking back on it, awful leadership experience, I learned some of the rudimentals of working with people and being in charge of stuff. But I brought self-discipline with me to the job. I remember at my initial interview, the person who was interviewing me saying, oh, you've been self-employed. How are you going to adjust the discipline in the police? I said, I've got self-discipline. I said, if I don't get out of bed at 2:30 in the morning and open that place,
we don't get paid.
And my family don't eat. So I brought self-discipline with me. But also, I think unwittingly at the time, quite passionate about organising things and stuff like that. If you reflect on police now and direct entry super, the first thing I'd say about both those two schemes is I think they are going to provide the service with some fantastic individuals that have got great talent, and maybe talent and experiences that we would not have. You know, they want to do police work, right, for certain reasons, and I think you're attracting small numbers of people in who we wouldn't have attracted previously, that all add to the great mix of different people. We shouldn't be threatened by it. I think some of them may find that the work that they're doing isn't what they thought it was. Haven't we all, from time to time?
Yeah.
And I think they'll find that the way you just get on with it and adapt very quickly to what's in front of you in operational policing is understated. I think we just do get on with it. We're quite humble about it, but we are very adaptable in the operational environment. Maybe not in other ways. We're not as adaptable, but we can improvise, can't we? And we can fix things and get things done. And I think that's an aspect of their experience that they will find quite surprising. The broad range of what you need to know how to do.
Yes.
Because I remember thinking, right, when I was a PC and I got promoted to sergeant at 3.5 years, I thought, oh my, there's certain things I'm worried if they happen when I was a sergeant driving round. And then when I got to inspector, there was other things I was worried about that might happen because I wasn't proficient at them. So it went from, like, I'm worried if I get a firearms job to I'm worried if I get a plane crash. You know, all the things that might happen.
Mm.
But actually, most things you come across, you improvise and get on with them. And you have enough people around you to help you do it. So I think, you know, it's a massive challenge for those individuals. I think it's a challenge for us to not see it as a threat, to put our shoulders back and see it as, be proud of the fact that some people who are very different want to come and do our job with us and not be threatened by it. But at the same time, be really clear on what support people need and what they need to do themselves to get up to speed with the role of a frontline police officer, which is still the toughest job in policing. There's no two ways about it. Because you don't know what's going to happen, do you?
No, you don't.
When you walk in the front room.
Finally, what does Andy Rose do to look after his own well-being?
Well, I talk a lot to other people in my life who fortunately are good listeners. I try to avoid negative people, if I can, at all possible, because I have a theory that it's not legitimate for people to, and some people do this, try to push their negative, pessimistic views of life onto you. And I spent a lot of time in parade rooms and vans with people like that who just brought the mood down.
Is that a sign of getting older, do you think?
Yeah, I'm less tolerant of people who, I think, don't, you know, you want to have that view on life, that's up for you. I think it's, my view of it is it doesn't get you anywhere. I think from my point of view, I try at all costs to work with people who I think are not Pollyanna thinkers. They're realistic people, but they've got energy and enthusiasm to change things that they think are wrong, not just wallow and complain about them. And I keep fit, obsessed with keeping fit, because the job I do, some days, your physical fitness is what actually comes into play.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And some of the command roles that you might find. So Christmas Day, you know, we go out on Christmas Day and meet people. I'm not sure they're always that pleased to see us, to be quite frank, but Steve and I do it. And you're out early at 7 o'clock. Through that day, I was cover. Floods were starting to happen. I was getting calls all day. I end up at 9 o'clock at night. Not that sorry, actually, to be released from the charades game that I was playing with family in Lancaster. And I come into work and open up the gold because we needed to. And I didn't go home from work until 7 a.m. the following morning. Mm. You've got to be physically fit to do that, to cope with it. You've got to be physically fit and you've got to be mentally on the ball. So I am a great believer in, I'm very, very fortunate that, touch wood, I'm physically in good shape, but I do keep myself in as good a condition as I can.
Andy Rhodes, thank you very much.